Well, Shabbat Shalom. Welcome. And we're taking a break this morning from our Genesis teaching, and we're going to be looking into Hanukkah. It's been about 4 years since I've talked about the festival of Hanukkah, and I've been trying to address the different holy days as we go through them. Now, there are seven Moedim, seven holy days that the Torah commands us to observe. But then there are two additional ones. There's Hanukkah and Purim. Purim will be coming up in the early spring. Now, Hanukkah you don't find anywhere in the Hebrew scriptures, but it's in the Gospels. Purim you don't find mentioned in the New Testament scriptures, but you find it mentioned in the book of Esther. And both of these books, they're like two halves of menorah. They both have to do with exile. In the book of Esther, you find the people physically exiled from Israel, and they're in the land of Persia, but their hearts are close to God. But when we read about Hanukkah, we find that the Jewish people were still in the land. They were not in physical exile, but their hearts were far from God and being lured away from Him. And there's two kinds of exiles. There's physical and there's spiritual. And these two books, one that's described in the Hebrew scriptures, one described in the Greek scriptures, describe these two kinds of exile. So it's always good to study these two holy days together. And by the way, just a little tidbit here. We were just singing Mi Kamocha. You know, this holiday, the hero of this holiday of Hanukkah is Judas Maccabeus, or Judas Maccabee. And Maccabee is four letters. Mem, Kaf, Beit, Yud. And when you sing Mi Kamocha, Mi Kamocha Ba'elim Adonai, those four words start with the four letters that spell Maccabee. And just a little trivia. It doesn't cost extra. That's free. You can have that. All right. So Hanukkah. Now, there are two books we'll be using this morning. This book, this blue one, this is the book of Daniel, the prophet Daniel. And we'll be looking in Daniel this morning, Daniel chapter 11. And this book, the book of Daniel, was written around 550 B.C., 550 B.C., thereabouts, book of Daniel. And in chapter 11, he prophesies in tremendous detail, incredible detail, about the coming of Alexander the Great, how he'll conquer the known world, how he'll die as a young man. He won't have any children. His kingdom will be split up among his four generals. And these four generals, the one in the north in Syria, one in the south in Egypt, one in the west, which is in Macedonia, the area of Greece, and one in the east, which is in Persia, and right smack in the middle is Israel. And they're always fighting over Israel. He prophesied this. He prophesies about how a Syrian lady, a princess, will be sent to Egypt to enter into marriage. Her name is Cleopatra. It doesn't give her name, it describes her. What will happen to her? You thought Cleopatra was Egyptian, didn't you? No, she wasn't. She's from the north. And when she went down to lure the Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, into marriage, she turned up being lured herself and just stayed there and became the queen of Egypt. And she happened to be Antiochus IV's sister, who is the villain of our story of Hanukkah. All of that is prophesied in incredible detail about 425 years before any of it happened. Right? So this book's written 550 roughly BC. Talk about events that would take place about 425 years later. Now this book is the Apocrypha. And some Bibles include the books of the Apocrypha. It's not inspired scripture, even though the original King James Version, 1611, included the Apocrypha, later editions do not. But in this book, this is not inspired scripture, but it's good history. There's a lot of wisdom, a lot of good comments. This is good reading. It just doesn't go to the level of God's Word. And in here is the book of Maccabees, 1 Maccabees, 2 Maccabees, which is just good, solid history. And Maccabees describes the fulfillment of the things Daniel prophesied. And this is written by eyewitnesses. Eyewitnesses to the history that Daniel had prophesied more than 400 years earlier. So what we're going to be doing here at the beginning of this teaching is looking at a verse or two from Daniel, then look at the fulfillment in the book of Maccabees. I'll be going back and forth to give you the background of what Hanukkah is about. Now, the word Hanukkah means dedication. And we call it Hanukkah because on Hanukkah, the temple that was defiled was rededicated. So let's get right into the story. Now, first of all, we think of Hanukkah, we think of menorahs, we think of dreidels, little gold coins, eating potato latkes, and just having a lot of food and fun and frivolity. But that could be very misleading when we begin to look at the roots of what Hanukkah is. Hanukkah was, the original Hanukkah, it was surrounded with war, death, persecution, slaughter, torture. It was an incredibly horrible, dark time. And by understanding how horrible and dark it was, the events that gave rise to this holy day will help us appreciate the joy of what this day is all about, and what this week is all about. So we begin with the bad guy, Antiochus IV Epiphanes, who is called by Daniel 400 plus years before he's born, a despicable person. This is what Daniel says in Daniel 11, 21, and then we'll pick it up again, verses 29 to 31. And in his place, by his, he's referring to Seleucus IV's place, who is the king, a despicable person will arise. By the way, a little footnote, everything you read about Antiochus IV is a forerunner of the Antichrist himself. And that's one of the reasons we have all these details in Daniel 11. Because God is saying everything is going to be fulfilled by Antiochus way back here is just a partial fulfillment of what the Antichrist himself will do in the future. So, a despicable person will arise on whom the honor of kingship has not been conferred. In other words, he didn't inherit kingship. He basically flattered and killed and connived his way to the top and became the king by nefarious purposes and nefarious ways. But he will come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue. At the appointed time, he will return and come into the south, but this last time will not turn out the way it did before. I know that's totally confusing. I'm not going to go into the details. You can get a commentary and read what that's about. But it says, for the ships of Kittim, that is Rome, the ships of Rome will come against him. Therefore, he will be disheartened and will return and become enraged at the Holy Covenant and take action. So he will come back and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. Get that? He will show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. That's kind of like the days we live in. You forsake God, turn away from the Bible, the world holds you in regard. You embrace the scriptures, you want to follow them and teach them, the world looks at you like you're trash. The world will tolerate anything at all except one who wants to follow God, one who wants to live a righteous life. That is intolerable to the world these days. Armed forces will come at his order and profane the sanctuary, that's the temple, and fortress. They will abolish the daily burnt offering and set up the abomination that causes desolation. Remember, Yeshua refers to this. And Yeshua is not referring to what did happen, but he says it's going to happen again with the Antichrist. So, that's what Daniel prophesied around 550 BC or earlier. Now, I want to read to you a little bit from 1 Maccabees. Now, remember, this is not inspired scripture, but it is good history. It's a good, reliable history. I'm going to read a little bit from chapter 1, verses 20 to 25. This is what it says. After subduing Egypt, that's in the south, Antiochus returned to the 143rd year. He went up against Israel and came to Jerusalem with a strong force. He arrogantly entered the sanctuary. He went into the temple, into the Holy of Holies, and took the golden altar, the lampstand for the light, and all its utensils. He took also the table for the bread of the presence, the cups for drink offerings, the bowls, the golden censers, the curtain, that's the parquet that divides the Holy of Holies from the holy place, the crowns and the gold decoration on the front of the temple. He stripped it all off. He took the silver and the gold and the costly vessels. He took also the hidden treasures that he found. Taking them all, he went into his own land. He shed much blood and spoke with great arrogance. Israel mourned deeply in every community. Then skipping on over to verse 41, it says, "Then the king wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people." One of the things you have to understand is that unlike Hitler, who just wanted to eradicate the Jews from the face of the earth, Antiochus didn't want to do that. What he wanted to do was Hellenize them. He wanted them to embrace the culture of Greece. That's what he wanted. And in fact, at first, he kind of let them keep their religion, keep your traditions, just embrace the Greek culture. Kind of sounds like today. It's like they don't care if you do the churchy things, but just embrace the world. Embrace, tolerate all the things the world tolerates. And we hear so much in the world about, we just want to be one world. We just want to be unified, right? Yeah, but at the cost of righteousness. But listen again. "Then the king wrote to his whole kingdom," this is Antiochus writing, "that all should be one people, that all should give up their particular customs. All the Gentiles accepted the command of the king. Many, even from Israel, gladly adopted his religion. They sacrificed to idols and profaned the Sabbath. And the king sent letters by messengers to Jerusalem and the towns of Judah. He directed them to follow customs strange to the land, to forbid burnt offerings and sacrifices and drink offerings in the sanctuary. He instructed them to profane Sabbaths and festivals, to defile the sanctuary and the priests, to build altars and sacred precincts and shrines for idols, to sacrifice pigs and other unclean animals, and to leave their sons uncircumcised. They were to make themselves abominable by everything unclean and profane, so that they would forget the Torah and change all the ordinances." He added, quote, "And whoever does not obey the command of the king shall die," unquote. In such words, he wrote to his whole kingdom. He appointed inspectors over all the people and commanded the towns of Judah to offer sacrifice town by town. Many of the people, everyone who forsook the Torah, joined them. And they did evil in the land. They drove Israel into hiding in every place of refuge they had. Now on the 15th day of Kislev, in the 145th year, they erected a desolating sacrilege on the altar of burnt offering. The abomination of desolation that Daniel referred to up here. Here it's fulfilled. They also built altars in the surrounding towns of Judah and offered incense at the doors of the houses and in the streets. The books of the Torah that they found, they tore to pieces and burned with fire. Anyone found possessing the Book of the Covenant, or anyone who adhered to the Torah, was condemned to death by decree of the king. They kept using violence against Israel, against those who were found month after month in the towns. On the 25th day of the month, they offered sacrifice on the altar that was on top of the altar of burnt offering. According to the decree, they put to death the women who had their children circumcised, and their families, and those who circumcised them. Listen to this. "And they hung the infants from their mothers' necks. But many in Israel stood firm and were resolved in their hearts not to eat unclean food. They chose to die rather than to be defiled by food or to profane the Holy Covenant. And they did die. Very great wrath came upon Israel." Horrible time. One of the parts that's included in this, and it talks about, is in the Holy of Holies, he sets up a statue of Zeus. One of the traditions is that this statue of Zeus had a head of Antiochus on top. Antiochus did openly proclaim to be God, by the way. There he is. That's not the one that was in the Holy of Holies, but there's a bust of Antiochus IV Epiphanes. I mean, you look at him and think, oh, you make a good neighbor. But you know, you can't tell a book by its cover, can you? And here's an artist's rendering of There's the temple and the altar, and can you see what they're carrying up to the altar to sacrifice? It's a pig. And here you see down here a soldier with a spear, and he's putting to death anyone who would not cooperate. Now here, this artist put the statue of Zeus right here on the altar. You see that? So when they took these sacrifices, it was to a foreign god. So we continue. Now Daniel, back to chapter 11, verses 32-33, wrote this: "And by smooth words he will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly toward the covenant. But the people who know their God," and that's important. Daniel says, "the people who know their God will display strength." Notice Daniel didn't say those who believe in God. A lot of people believe in God. But the people who, you can tell the difference between who's going to stand in persecution and who won't, are the people who know him. See, if you just believe in God without really knowing him, what you have is a correct opinion. What you have is maybe good theology, but you don't have faith. You cannot have faith in a God you don't know, any more than I can have a faith in a person I don't know and I've never met. I want to know you. I want to get to know you. I want to look you in the eye before I put my faith in you to do something. It's like some things you can buy on the internet, but other things you just don't buy on the internet. It's like, I want to see it first. I want to check it out before I will put my faith in this, put my money behind it. If you don't know God, you're not going to stand. Just having a correct opinion isn't enough. You got to get to know him. And when you know him, you love him, you trust him. And your correct opinion, your theology, turns into something much more solid, something much more real. It says the people who know their God will display strength and take action. And those who have insight among the people will give understanding to the many. Yet they will fall by sword, by flame, by captivity, by plunder for many days. And going back to 1 Maccabees, we see this fulfilled. Chapter 2, I'll read 7 verses. "In those days, Mattathiah, son of John, son of Simeon, a priest of the family of Jorib, moved from Jerusalem and settled in Modin. He had 5 sons, John, surnamed Gadi, Simon, called Thasi, Judas, called Maccabeus." Maccabeus means hammerhead. He must have been a stubborn guy. "Eleazar, called Avaron, and Jonathan, called Apphus. He saw the blasphemies being committed in Judah and Jerusalem and said, 'Alas, why was I born to see this? The ruin of my people, the ruin of the holy city, and to live there when it was given over to the enemy, the sanctuary given over to aliens.'" And it goes on. And as you read about this family, and especially Judas, who became their leader, you begin to realize that these are people who have trust and faith in God, who know God, who take action, and they resist. Now, as we read earlier, and as it goes on in more detail in Maccabees, Antiochus issued 6 particular, what we call evil decrees. We read about these, and they're referred to over again in Maccabees. He ordered the destruction of Torah scrolls, enforced the eating of swine's flesh. He forbade circumcision, forbade observance of the Sabbath and the Moedim. He forbade the daily sacrifices, and he desecrated the temple with the abomination of desolation. Horrible things. These are all things the Antichrist himself will do. When you read about in Revelation, you find that the Antichrist will do the same things. It's a horrible time. Going back to Maccabees, I'm going to skip ahead to chapter 4. This is when the Maccabees decide to start fighting and resisting in a physical way. These were not pacifists. It says in 1 Maccabees 4, we'll start with verse 36. "Then Judas and his brothers said, 'See, our enemies are crushed. Let us go up to cleanse the sanctuary and dedicate it.' So all the army assembled and went up to Mount Zion. There they saw the sanctuary desolate, the altar profaned, and the gates burned. In the courts they saw bushes sprung up as in a thicket. I mean, there were actual bushes and weeds growing up inside the court of the temple. They saw the bushes spring up, or as one of the mountains. They saw also the chambers of the priests in ruins. Then they tore their clothes and mourned with great lamentation. They sprinkled themselves with ashes and fell face down on the ground. And when the signal was given with the trumpets, they cried out to heaven. Then Judas detailed men to fight against those in the citadel until he had cleansed the sanctuary. He chose blameless priests devoted to the Torah, and they cleansed the sanctuary and removed the defiled stones to an unclean place. They deliberated what to do about the altar of burnt offering, which had been profaned, and they thought it best to tear it down, so that it would not be a lasting shame to them that the Gentiles had defiled it. So they tore down the altar and stored the stones in a convenient place on the temple hill until a prophet should come to tell them what to do with them. Well, let me explain what's going on. They could replace all the stuff in the temple, but the altar had pigs sacrificed on it. It had been defiled. And there was a big argument. You can read about this in the Talmud. Some of the sages said, some of the rabbis said, we can cleanse these stones and reuse them. Others says, no, you can't. They've been defiled by pig's blood. And others said, yeah, but they're attached to the ground, and things attached to the ground cannot be defiled. They said, but the stones themselves were set on top, and blah, blah, blah. They went on this argued. They said, all right, oy vey, what we'll do, we'll take the altar apart, but we'll save the stones until, it says, until a prophet should come to tell them what to do with them. So they stored the stones of the altar, and the Talmud tells us up in the northeast corner of a chamber. There's a lot of arguments of what northeast corner of what chamber. But anyways, northeast corner, somewhere on the Temple Mount. Now, this describes one of the battles right there for the temple. But you're going to find battle after battle after battle leading up to this. And then afterwards, after they cleanse and rededicate the temple, they're still fighting. Don't get it in your mind there's one battle that the Maccabeans won. There were a number of battles, and they won every single one of them. This tiny little Jewish force made up mostly of priests. What did priests know about using swords and spears? And they had very few weapons. The only weapons they had was the one they stole from the enemy troops. But God blessed them every single time, and this little tiny Jewish force decimated the most mighty army in the world at the time. Rome was on the rise. Rome would reach its pinnacle a century or so later. But right now, this Syrian army was the force to be reckoned with. Let me continue reading a little bit more. Then they took unhewn stones, as the Torah directs, and built a new altar like the former one. They also rebuilt the sanctuary, the interior of the temple, and consecrated the courts. They made new holy vessels and brought the lampstand, the altar of incense, and the table into the temple. Then they offered incense on the altar and lit the lamps on the lampstand, and these gave light in the temple. They placed the bread on the table and hung up the curtains. Thus they finished all the work they had undertaken. Now, this does not refer to the miracle of lights, but it does give us the date as the 25th of Kislev, 165 B.C., the temple's rededicated. And if we go on a bit further, the next few verses, which I have on the screen, says early in the morning on the 25th day of the month Kislev. And it's interesting that this year, the month of Kislev, which we're in now, and the month of December happen to exactly coincide. So at sundown tonight is the 25th of Kislev. Tomorrow is the 25th of December. Very unusual that they completely come together like this, but they do. So on the 25th of Kislev, they rose and offered sacrifice, as the Torah directs, on the new altar of burnt offering that they had built. So they celebrated the Hanukkah, the dedication of the altar, for 8 days and joyfully offered burnt offerings. Now Maccabees does not reference the miracle of the oil, but other writings do. The Talmud does in two places. And something that's older than the Talmud, the Megillat Antiochus, which was originally written in Aramaic, is written right during this time. says this: after this, the children of the Hasmoneans, these are the Maccabees, came to the temple. They rebuilt the gates that had been destroyed, repaired the breaches, and purified from the corpses of impurity. And they searched for extra pure olive oil to light the menorah, but only found one flask that was sealed with the signet ring of the high priest. In other words, this is pure, this is holy oil. And this is prepared with a special formula. It was sanctified, set apart, no impurities. It was kosher, so to speak. They only found one small flask, one day's worth. And they thus knew it was pure. And in it, there was only enough oil to kindle for one day. And the God of heaven, who causes his name to rest there, gave a blessing in the oil. And they lit from it for 8 days. In other words, one day's supply lasted for eight. That's one of the miracles of Hanukkah. This is why a Hanukkah menorah, it has a center stalk, but then it's got eight branches to it. The menorah in the temple has seven branches. But the Hanukkah that we use during Hanukkah, there's eight branches. So we add one more light each day of the eight nights of Hanukkah. And this is why we do Hanukkah for 8 days. All right. Now, let's just pause for a second. I thought I saw Jim's hand go for a second. I think we have a microphone floating around back here. So let's see if there are any questions, anything that needs clarified. Okay. Yes, Jim.
Was the followers, or the Maccabees, was they a follower of a ruler, or were they like a vigilante group? Hated the way those that evidently disliked Israel.
By the ruler, do you mean Antiochus, the bad guy? Or just the ruler?
Was they obeying orders of a king?
They did not have a king at that time. And they were of the priests. They were related to the high priest of Israel at the time. And they were of the tribe of Levi, kind of like Moses was.
And you could call them vigilantes. But they were sanctified vigilantes because God blessed them. God called them, inspired them. It's time to rise up and take back and to rebel and defend God's honor. And they did. Yeah. You're welcome. Any other questions? Over here for Brian. Oh, here's another microphone coming, Brian.
This is a three-parter. So why?
Oh my goodness!
Do you think that the Book of Maccabees is not included in the Tanakh or New Testament? And do you think it should be? And then the third question: is it included in the Catholic Scriptures?
Okay, that's all three parts. Those are easy. We'll start with the last one. Yes, it is included in the Catholic Bible. All these books in the Apocrypha you can find there. In fact, if you want really good reading, there's some amazing, amazing wisdom here. And there's nothing dangerous in the Apocrypha. And by the way, when I refer to the Apocrypha, I'm referring to a particular set of books. I'm not talking about these lost books of the Bible. You see these things in bookstores. Don't bother with that trash. Don't worry about these lost books. If they're lost books of the Bible, they're lost for a particular reason. Okay, and they should stay that way. But the Apocrypha is different. And in fact, there's even a second book of Esther included here that seems like it just goes seamlessly right along with the book of Esther and gives you the rest of the story. There are what are believed to be extra writings of Solomon, and it's really amazing stuff. It's good to read. Why is it included in our Bibles? One of the reasons is that Yeshua never quotes these books, so we leave them out. That's one of the reasons. Also, when you read Maccabees, there are bits that are inspiring. It doesn't have the same feel. I don't know how else to describe it. When you read Maccabees, it doesn't have the same feel as when you're reading the book of Acts or one of the Gospels. It doesn't have the same feel. But when you read it, it's gripping, and you're reading good history. But some of that's be more than just good history to be included in the covers of the Bible. Okay? And so the rule was, if in doubt, throw it out. And that's what many of the guys did who assembled our New Testament scriptures.
Even though the Jewish people read these books, they themselves, Israel's never seen this as being part of the Holy Scriptures, a part of the Tanakh. They don't put it in the Tanakh. We don't put it in the Tanakh. You know, after all, they had this before we did. And so hopefully that answers your questions. But with that said, it's still good stuff. Everything in here is good. There's nothing dangerous. It's not heretical. Not going to lead you astray. In fact, it'll probably encourage your faith, and you'll find yourself underlining bits of it. All right? So, are we good? All right. Any other questions or comments before we move on? Tim, it's good to see you here. How's that new baby boy?
Great. He's in the nursery.
Is he? So we finally get to see Jeffrey. Oh, wonderful, wonderful. All right. I thought he'd be starting school by the time we got to see him. All right. Wonderful. Good. All right. Well, back to Maccabees. So the question is, where did the Hasmoneans put the desecrated stones? And you're going to think, well, what's the big deal with that? Hold on, you'll see. According to the Talmud, Avodah Zarah 52b, the northeastern chamber, within it the Hasmoneans concealed the stones of the altar that the Greeks had defiled when they seized control of the temple. The question is, what's the northeastern chamber? Well, this is not a floor plan of Solomon's temple, or even of the restored temple after the Maccabees got back, or after Ezra and Nehemiah got back from the Babylonian exile, or even after the Maccabees started restoring it. This is Herod's temple. Question is, where is the northeast chamber? Well, we know that up here is the north, and down here is the south, which would make this over here the east and this the west, right? So northeast would be somewhere up in this area over in here. Well, there's one tractate of the Talmud called Midot, which is all about the temple. But nobody knows that they're talking about Solomon's temple or Herod's temple. That's the big question. And there it describes a chamber called the Chamber of Fire, which is, it's on the other side of the temple. It's right back over in here. It's back on the other side of this wall. If you see a model of the temple and you see a structure sticking out of the wall of the temple that has a gold dome on it, that's called the Chamber of Fire. They call it the Chamber of Fire because that's where the priest would go to warm up. Because you see, the priest didn't wear shoes. They always went barefoot in the temple precincts. They never wore shoes here, and their feet got really cold. Just that simple. They also slept in there at night. And so they kept the fire going. And in this chamber of fire, in the northeast corner, was a little room, a little closet, called the Closet of the Seals. And it gives the dimensions. But another guy in the Talmud says, whoa, wait a minute. There's no way in this world you could take the stones of this massive altar and squeeze them into this little closet. That cannot be the northeast corner. Other people say, well, the northeast corner is this northeast chamber up here, but we know that wasn't it either. Our best bet, our best guess, is that the northeast corner is referring to something up in here. You see, this long porch here in Herod's temple is called Solomon's Porch. It's the only part of the temple structure, this temple mount, that dated back to the time of Solomon's temple. And archaeologists have noticed that some of the columns and the ruins of these columns are still there. When I was in Israel, not my last trip, but yeah, I guess it was my last trip, we went up on the Temple Mount and we just did a circuit all the way around. And you can see all the ruins. And some of the ruins, you can see burn marks on them from the fire in 70 AD when the Romans burned so much of the temple structure. So our best guess is that here on Solomon's porch, Solomon's portico was a covered walkway. So when it rained, people could go there. And people sit there in the shade. It's a good place to talk. Because this is a very high elevation. Usually it's not a cloud in the sky. It's a great place to get a sunburn. In fact, I got an epic sunburn when I was there last time, walking around the Temple Mount. So it's great to have some shade. And so our best guess is when it talks about the northeast corner, a chamber, it's up here in Solomon's porch. All right? Why is that important? Well, this has to do with Yeshua. Remember how we read in Maccabees, they stored the stones until a prophet would come and tell them what to do with them? So then another argument comes up. And well, how do we recognize this prophet? How do we recognize the Messiah when he comes? And unfortunately, the work from which this comes has not yet been translated into English. It's still in Hebrew. Hopefully, sometime soon, this work will be translated. This work comes from a rabbi whose name is the Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi. He was born in 1770, lived to 1857, and he did all the research and he drew from the Jewish writings and put together what would be five proofs of the Messiah. He said that the Messiah would make a public statement on Solomon's porch. He would claim that he was the Messiah. He would provide at least two witnesses to his identity. He would calm the fears of the people, and he claimed unity with Adonai. And he derived this from the writings and all these bits and pieces of the ancient writings of Israel. So then we come to John chapter 10. It says, then came Hanukkah in Jerusalem. Now your English translation probably says the Feast of Dedication. Well, that's what the word Hanukkah means, dedication. So it was Hanukkah in Jerusalem. It was winter. And Yeshua was walking around inside the temple area in Solomon's colonnade. Now, the people who were there at that time were expecting the Messiah to come in that generation. There were a lot of false messiahs that came in Yeshua's lifetime, some before and some right after, but they expected in that generation the Messiah to appear. Daniel prophesies this as well in chapter 9. And says that when the temple is restored, and it was restored later under Ezra and Nehemiah, and the temple would be destroyed by the Romans, and it was in 70 AD, he says, in between those two events, the Messiah comes. And he dies, but not for his own sake, for the sake of others. Well, we know the temple is restored. We know the temple is destroyed. Messiah had to come there. And another writing said, even narrowed it down even more to the very generation of Yeshua. So everybody's looking for the Messiah. And they were aware of these prophecies that the Messiah would walk here. And he would announce the fact that he's the Messiah. So here's Yeshua on Hanukkah, walking in the place where these desecrated stones are stored. And so what did the Judeans do? So the Judeans surrounded him and said to him, how much longer are you going to keep us in suspense? If you're the Messiah, tell us publicly. Tell us now. We want to know. This is the time. This is the place. Yeshua answered them, I've already told you. So there's number one. Yes, I'm the Messiah and I've already told you I am. But you don't trust me. What are the witnesses? The works I do in my Father's name testify on my behalf. Those are my witnesses. I don't have two witnesses. I've got thousands of witnesses. All these works I've done. But the reason you don't trust me is that you are not included among my sheep. My sheep listen to my voice. I recognize them and they follow me. I give them eternal life. And he had to comfort the people. And that's what he does here. They will absolutely never be destroyed. You see, on Hanukkah, what are they commemorating? The fact that this wicked man, Antiochus, had come and destroyed so many of the Jewish people. And Messiah's comfort him and says, my sheep will never be destroyed. Oh yeah, they might be persecuted, be put to death. They'll never be wiped out because they're going to rise again from the dead. They'll never be destroyed and no one will snatch them from my hands. My Father who gave them to me is greater than all, and no one can snatch them from the Father's hands. And then here's number four. I and the Father are one. Oh yeah, I skipped the first one. He had to be in Solomon's colonnade. So back all the numbers up, or move them up one. All right. I and the Father are one. We're echad. Now look what happens. Once again, the Judeans picked up rocks in order to stone him. Where'd they get the rocks? The temple was kept pristine and clean. It's a holy place. There's not gravel and rocks laying around. Gravel wouldn't be big enough to stone somebody with anyway. Where'd these big rocks come from? They're in Solomon's colonnade, Solomon's porch, and they pick up rocks to stone him. Now, I'm just making an assumption here. It would be these rocks, the rocks from the desecrated altar. They picked up rocks in order to stone him. Yeshua answered them, "You've seen me do many good deeds that reflect the Father's power. For which one of these deeds are you stoning me?" The Judeans replied, "We're not stoning you for any good deed, but for blasphemy, because you, who are only a man, are making yourself out to be God." Now, Yeshua was not making himself out to be God, but Antiochus did. Antiochus came as a despicable person who claimed to be God in the flesh, claimed to be God himself, and he tried to destroy the Jews. Here comes the very Son of God, the one in whom the Spirit of God dwelt fully, the sinless one, the Messiah. And he didn't even come claiming to be God. We kind of know he is, though, don't we? But he didn't come claiming to be God. And yet they're ready to kill him. What a contrast. You've seen the connections with Hanukkah? And the more you think about this, the more you're going to see these little subtle connections between John chapter 10 and the story of Hanukkah and the Maccabees. Now, when I sent you an email this week, I asked you a question. That is to identify the two great miracles of Hanukkah. So, who wants to name one of the miracles? Somebody just shout it out. What's one of the miracles? Okay, the miracle of the oil. That's the second miracle. Miracle of the oil. One day supply burnt for eight. But there's a miracle that took place before that. Yes. The victory, we'll just put that, victory over the Syrian army. Remember, a small group, untrained Jewish priests, right? And they overthrow the most mighty army on earth. This is an army that whose generals have been trained by Alexander the Great himself. These were the best in the world. And there were many of them, many thousands of them. And this little group destroyed the bigger group. Not once. But as I go through Maccabees, I count at least over a half a dozen battles against this mightier army. And every single time they beat them. That's an incredible miracle. And there's a story here for us. You see, we all want the miracle of the oil. We love that. There's no violence, no bloodshed. We just want to, you know, this little light of mine or pass it on. You know, I'm dating myself. Remember the song, Pass It On? It only takes a spark to get a fire going. And we want to pass this. Anyways, there was a lot of hippie influence in the church when I was growing up. But we all love that bit. But before we can really be lights, there must be this victory over the enemy. And too many of us want the miracle of the oil before we want the miracle of the victory. Where we have to stand against opposing forces in our lives. Says, yes, Lord, just make me a light. Okay, and then he puts a sword in our hand to fight first. Get victory over your impulses. Victory over your own fleshly lust. Get victory over your fears. Get victory over the worry that people are going to make fun of you if you follow me. Get victory over everything in your life that you're afraid of other than me. And when you've destroyed that, and I'll help you destroy it, but you've got to make the choice. You've got to take the first step. And you take up the sword to fight against the things that you're afraid of. And you fight against the worldly pull that will say, come on, compromise. You know, this week, what do we read in our Torah portion? We read about Joseph and Potiphar's wife trying to seduce him. Lie with me. Come lie with me. That's the call of the world. Just come on, just lay down. We'll just cuddle a little bit. But Joseph wouldn't. He wouldn't. Even when it cost him going to prison, he would not compromise his convictions. He wouldn't do it. And he fled from her. She grabbed the cloak off of his back and said, look, he was trying to rape me. And he didn't even, there's not a word of self-defense when he was accused and put in prison. Sold by his brothers to Egypt. And now he's in Egypt. Now he goes to prison. It's like, Lord, I'm serving you. I'm doing everything you want me to do. I'm trying to be a living sacrifice. And look what happens. But I don't see a word of complaint in Joseph. Not one single word. And what becomes of him? He becomes the master of Egypt. He becomes the savior of the world. He saved the known world from famine because of his actions. Incredible story. That's the story of this week in our Torah portion. We have to have victory over the pull of the world. Let me show you something. Psalm 40, verse 2. We know this passage real well. He brought me up out of the pit of destruction, out of the miry clay, and he set my feet upon a rock, making my footsteps firm. Yippee, you know, we're all happy, yes. That word miry, this is the word, hayavan. And this is the definite article means the. Okay, that's this. You just put a hay in front of a word, makes it the. But miry is the word yavan. You know what yavan is? Yavan is the Hebrew word for Greece. The country of Greece. Yeah. So now let's read it with that understanding. He brought me up out of the pit of destruction, out of the Greek clay, the Hellenistic clay, the humanist clay, the man-centered clay, the world order clay. You understand what's being done here? It's an incredible thing that God has hidden in this song. And this is written a long time before Daniel lived. It's written a long time before Alexander the Great came into being and conquered the world and started the country of Greece. But it's amazing that the miry clay that today still that wants to entrap us is the clay of Greek culture. We often talk about the Greek mindset versus the Hebraic mindset. And Greek culture was that man is the center of the universe. And man's appetites are all pure and good. They should be indulged. And everything is about the worship of man. Everything centers around man. And a creator of the universe, God, who has time for that? And it was beautiful. It was attractive. I don't think we have any idea the kind of seduction there was for believers in the first century church. In the first century, these temples to Diana and temples to Artemis, they were the same person. These temples were beautiful. You know what you could do? You could go there and get food. You're a young man, they'll provide you with a priestess there to do with what you want. They'll give you a place to sleep. Yeah, just come on in. All you got to do is worship Diana here. Here's some incense. Burn some incense to her. Say this prayer to Diana. You can have whatever you want. Just pledge your allegiance to this goddess. Can you imagine the seduction that was? And then, to make it worse, and if you don't do this, if you don't acknowledge our gods, then we'll crucify you. And yet people had such a strong faith and knowledge of God that they withstood that. Many didn't. But then on the other hand, many did. And this is a miry clay. This is such a miry clay. And so, in this time in which we live, the question is, are we willing to fight the battle? God will give us the victory, but we have to do the fighting. He'll give you the victory. You have to conquer your fears and decide, I'm going to go against something that looks a lot bigger, a lot more experienced than me, but I'm going to put my faith in God. And when you fight it and get victory, then the miracle of the oil can take place in your life. And God can show what great things he can do with such a little thing as you. Right? We have to do number one, then number two. You got it? Okay, and I see Mim's hand up, so let's get a microphone to Mim.
I just have a thought and a question.
Sure.
And correct me if I am wrong. When you talk about the Greek are being attracted to men, okay, the exalted men, and so my thought is thinking about, you know, how the world, or even people who call themselves Christians, they try to give Jesus to the world, give Yeshua to the world. And then people who don't know God at all will see a picture of a man. But is it different Yeshua? If you don't embrace who he is, the God of the Word, the Torah and the Israel and the Hebrew and everything about that Yeshua that we have, then we need to be careful because, you know, we can be deceived by different Yeshua.
Absolutely. Yeah, we all want to make Yeshua into our image instead of letting God make us into his. And none of us are free for that. Let's make sure we get that straight. All of us, as long as we're in this world, we're still getting to know God. We're still getting to know Yeshua. So all of us have distortions of how we think about him, and we may not even know what those distortions are. But we will present to the world the Yeshua that we know. We'll present to the world the God that we imagine. We have to just make very sure that our thoughts are completely transformed by this book. Because this is the way we know about God and about Yeshua. And if you teach a Yeshua who did not keep the Torah, well, that's not the Yeshua of the Bible. If you keep a Yeshua who is an evangelical or a Catholic or a Mormon or Jehovah's Witness or a Muslim, the Muslims teach Jesus was a Muslim. You're not teaching the Yeshua of the Bible. He was Jewish. And even then, it's not that simple because he butted heads with the Jewish leadership. So what kind of a Jew was he? He's one who loved God with all of his heart, soul, and strength, loved his neighbors himself, and he kept the Torah perfectly. Now, that's what we want to shoot for. And that's a load. That's enough. That's a lifetime there. But the more we get to know him as he is, then the more we'll reflect him to the world. And not trying to make him cool, not trying to make him this or that. He's perfect the way he is. Don't add to him. Don't take away from him. Present him as he is. And he wants us to be like him because that's who we present. So I thank you for your question. That's a great question. I don't think my answer was as good as your question. We could have just left your question stand. But thank you, ma'am. So we'll finish with this. There's the word Hanukkah. And it says, there's a quote by Rabbi Arya Strikoff. He says, Adonai educates, prepares us for the awesome light that will be revealed in the times of Messiah by allowing us to experience sparks of that light each year on Hanukkah. You know, as Hanukkah approaches at sundown, I encourage you, if you don't have a menorah, just at sundown, get a 2x4, drill some holes in it, stick candles in them, you're good to go. It's the light, it's not the fancy menorah that matters. In the Holocaust, they'd take a potato and hollow it out and get some bits of wax and a bit of string, something to light, just something to be a vessel for the light. The vessel doesn't matter. It's a matter of lighting that light. And each day we add to the light. It'd be two lamps, two lights tomorrow night, and then a third, and then a fourth, and a fifth. And you see the light grow. And that should be a picture of us as we give ourselves more to God. Our light should grow and get brighter. And traditionally, the menorahs are put in the windows of the homes. So the light goes to the world out there because they need what we have. We should share it with them. And it fulfills what Yeshua says. Let your light so shine among men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. Now, what day of the month is Hanukkah? What day does it start? 25th? You know the 25th word of the Bible is the word or, light? I don't think it's a coincidence. Yeah, it says, God said, Yihi or. That's let there be. Or is light. This is the 25th word of the Bible. But the word right before it, Yihi, let there be, happens to have a numerical value of 25. 10 plus 5 plus 10. That's not coincidence. It just isn't coincidence. And there's something special about this day of the year that I think from the very moment of creation, God realized, I want my people to be lights. And this special celebration, which, if I can call it this, is the most Christian of all the holy days, it's the one that we see our master proclaiming himself as Messiah. And as we become more the light God wants us to be, the more Messiah will be proclaimed through us. It's just that simple. And so we should embrace this holiday fully and completely and rejoice in it, but also purpose as we dedicate ourselves, our lives to him, that's going to be a battle. It's going to be a battle. But if we fight the battle, he'll give us the victory, and we will experience the miracle of light in our lives. That's the message of Hanukkah. That's the message I want to share with you. So let's close in prayer. Our Father and King, we praise you. We thank you for your blessings, your goodness. We thank you for your light. We thank you for the light of your Torah, for it's a lamp to our feet and a light to our path. We thank you for the light of Messiah. We thank you for the light of your Spirit. And we thank you that the one who is the light of the world looked upon us and said, you are lights of the world. So, Father, may we not hide our lights under the things of this world. But, Lord, may we be put in a place of service so that we can just be still and at peace and let our light do the speaking for us. And we'll give you praise for this miracle. In Yeshua's name, amen.